evolution sucks. I was trying to get you to. I was going to try and get you to spit that out. I was close.
Don't.
I was close.
You want the blood of Christ? How dare you try and get me to?
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other thing. Okay, so evolution. What do you want to start with? I think it's. Okay. How do I say this?
Well, I mean, I don't know what your specific issue with it is. So, I mean, I don't want to sit up here and lecture on the virtues of evolution, because that could go in literally any direction. But I guess I'm interested in, I don't know, you can just pick whatever gripe you have.
Okay. Fundamentally, the idea that natural selection happens, I clearly agree with. I agree with adaptation and natural selection. But the problem to me, and I'm surprised that you and your ilk just dismiss the idea that selecting something is selecting an existing option. It's not natural creation, it's natural selection. Selecting something that exists. And to me, random mutations creating the necessary improvement in functionality with which whatever organism could select it, there's no chance in hell that that's what's happening.
So you think that all of the possible variations among a species already exist in its genome, and so natural selection has no creative power?
I think that increased functionality is random increased functionality is antithetical to entropy, which governs this reality. Things get more disorganized over time. Things get worse over time. They don't become more complicated, and they don't accidentally gain functionality.
Yeah, but that's in a closed system, and Earth and life are open systems.
Okay, but the sun doesn't. Are you talking about? You're obviously talking about the sun.
Yeah.
Other than in the case of DNA.
Well,
go ahead.
I'm not talking about the sun. The sun is the source of like a constant supply of energy. But I'm not talking about the sun.
Well, that's the offsetting equilibrium, entropy equilibrium, whatever machine that you're invoking, right, is the sun.
Yeah, it continuously supplies Earth with energy. That's why that's why Earth is not a closed system.
Right, but other than DNA, which brilliantly, I would say clearly because it was designed to do so, can take the energy of the sun and use that result, whether through photosynthesis or caloric intake or whatever, reverse entropy or at least combat entropy. Aside from DNA utilizing, harnessing the energy of the sun and telling how to reassemble that information, what does the sun do when it provides energy to the Earth that isn't increasing entropy? That was complicated, I know. I can try and say it better if you want.
Well, because it's a closed system is a system where no matter or energy is added to it. And the sun constantly bombards Earth with photons. That is the source of all, and it's extremely low entropy energy. So that is the constant stream of energy. Earth doesn't get a constant stream of matter, but because of the sun's energy, matter cycles. We have a water cycle, and we have a carbon cycle, and we have a nitrogen cycle, and all that stuff. Crucially, Earth, although even if there was no sun, Earth would be a closed system. But Earth still has a lot of trapped internal heat, so there are interesting things that happen in our planet, like, you know, the shifting of tectonic plates and things like that, which is actually crucial for the reason I brought that up is because it's actually important if you want to have, like, nutrient cycles for reasons that are complicated and probably, well, whatever. So that's what the sun does. It's a constant stream of energy. It's sort of like, you know, your car is a closed system, but a sailboat isn't, because the sailboat is powered by a constant stream of energy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I would agree that the sun has an effect on the plate tectonic motion, or, you know, however exactly.
No, the sun doesn't do that. That's just Earth's interior does that.
I thought you said the sun was affecting plate tectonics somehow.
I said even if there was no sun, Earth, there would still be things that happen on Earth like plate tectonics, because the Earth has its own energy trapped within it.
Okay, fine. I thought you I was going to try and be nice and concede that, you know, sure, the sun could be affecting those things, but I think that all of the plate tectonic movement that we see was a result of the flood. So I was going to kind of politely agree, but you weren't saying that, so that's fine. Okay, so the sun. Well, let's just think about this for a second. If you have a car, you have a chair, you have your clothing, you leave your clothing, you leave your car, you leave your chair out in the sun over 20 years. How what's the state of whatever thing you leave out there? Does the sun it increase or decrease its entropy? Does it cause it to be more organized or less organized? Does it cause deterioration or does it make it into a better version of itself?
An inert object will fall to the mercy of entropy, I suppose. But living things aren't inert objects. But I mean, you could
Right, I said
argue
that
that.
DNA. DNA in its construct is able to take the energy, whatever the source is, photosynthesis, again, caloric intake, whatever, this resulting energy, and it's able to redistribute it to basically rebuild. But I would say, because I believe obviously DNA is designed, you have a conscious observer harnessing energy through basically an instruction set. It's not, again, you can say it's random and obviously believe abiogenesis happened or whatever, but aside, like, except for DNA, the sun's energy is always destructive. Always. Unless DNA can
I
repurpose
wouldn't,
it.
yeah, I wouldn't, so I wouldn't say that. So like you did a, you picked like, yeah, like plastic, it breaks down, right? But if there was no life on Earth, there would still be very interesting things that happen on our planet. Like hurricanes would form, like the weather would exist. And there are photochemical reactions that happen in our atmosphere where things are literally created, and then I guess they probably decay at some sort of rate. But no, I mean the sun has the ability to perpetuate systems, natural systems that aren't life either. And those systems would like literally be impossible without the sun.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if me looking for an example of the sun, you know, causing a more organized system, I don't know if a hurricane is the best example of that.
No,
Hurricanes don't build
a
anything.
hurricane is very much an organized thing, right? It's not, because what entropy, if something just increases in entropy, there are a lot of different ways to talk about this, but in general, things tend to cool down. They tend to become less organized. So a hurricane is very much an organized thing, right? That's not a very eloquent way of putting it, but.
It's where it devolved into. Okay, so yeah, it's fine. It does. It's got the, you know, the spiral sequence, which looks like, you know, kind of the Fibonacci. We've got the golden ratio, so that looks kind of organized, fine, but it's still going to be destructive in its path. And this is my problem with it. Like,
Yeah, we're not really
I'm
talking about evolution right now. So
right.
let's
Well,
try to get
okay.
back
So let's
to
go back
that.
to evolution. The issue I
Sure.
have with evolution is we have a house in northern Maine, and the climate up here is very extreme. Super cold in the winter, super dry, super wet and humid in the summer. The house is constantly being destroyed by basically Maine. Maine's trying to kill everything up here. If you don't actively, if I don't as the user go out and repaint and rebuild and whatever, in no time, in 100 years, in 60 years, your house is going to be a pile of wood, and then it's going to be just reassimilated back into the earth. This is how this reality works. Over time, the more time you have, the more destruction there is, the more disorganized things become, unless something with agency is basically reversing entropy. So a big issue I have with Darwinian evolution is the idea that random processes in a universe governed by decay and destruction created life, consciousness, symbiotic systems, reproductive systems, neurologic systems, whatever the brain is the most complicated computer, you know, potentially in the universe. Like the idea that random mutations reversed this, not just in a sustainable way, but went from nothing to us having a discussion on TikTok, you know, around the world with however many people tuning in with, you know, very good use of our language and very, you know, very high technological advancement. Random processes, to me, I would need substantial evidence that the Darwinian evolution does not have to support this claim. It's a wild, wild claim. It's an absolute belief system, and there's not nearly the evidence necessary, at least to go into school and say, we're going to teach everybody we figured this shit out.
You need evidence that what? That random processes can combat entropy?
What would I need evidence for?
Because that's kind of what you started off saying, but then at the end, I don't know what you were saying anymore.
Well, to clear up what I was saying, everything in this reality tends to disorder and decay. So to say that random mutations,
Including living
it's
things.
right.
Like we age,
Yes,
right?
we do.
But we reproduce. And so, I mean, in a way you can say, now we don't age because our DNA deteriorates. Well, actually, let me take that back. That is kind of, that is a small part of it because you get you get telomere shortening, for example. But what was I going to say? But that's not really that's not the reason why something ages, but sort of, you know, life begins anew when an organism reproduces, right? And obviously, like, bacteria don't have telomeres because they have a circular chromosome, so.
Okay. So, okay. Let me see if I can simplify this. I don't know if I will be able to, but the prediction that I think, if you read the Bible, which is obviously, I believe it's the Word of God, the prediction that you would make is that God created a fully mature universe at the get-go in Genesis. He created fully, functioning humans with no mutations. Adam would have been the most perfect genetic specimen that we'd ever seen. And that basically, over time, the universe would be falling apart, humankind would be falling apart. We see genetic entropy, which I think we'll talk about next in
Oh.
scripture. Yeah, I'm excited to talk about you. Maybe you can set me straight on it. Adam was 900 years, his son was 860, 830, 820, and in whatever 20 generations, they're down to like 120 years. This to me would be aggregation of mutation. Then when the geneticists start looking at the mutation rate, and they start calibrating the genetic clock, or the what is it called, the molecular clock. They 500 years now of data, we only see aggregation of deleterious mutations, or at least mutations. We don't see positive mutations.
Yeah, we
So,
do. We have so many positive mutations.
okay.
I wrote about genetic entropy for my book, so I don't really want to have a discussion on the Bible because the
That's
Bible
fine.
could be false and evolution could not be real
Right. I
at the
get that.
same time. I don't think it's not really all that relevant, I
I'm not
feel.
defending the Bible. I'm
But
just saying that in
like,
my model, we would make the prediction that things were good and they're getting worse, and that's what we see. Sorry, but we don't
yeah.
talk about the Bible.
So I seriously disagree with that because in terms of like life getting worse, whatever that means, I think that we would agree on the way you would measure that, and you measure it on fitness. Now, how do you measure fitness? Fitness is measured by the reproductive rate of the population. If their numbers are going down, then they have then their fitness is decreasing. If their population numbers are staying the same, then their fitness is basically static. And if their population numbers are going up, their fitness is increasing. Do you agree with that?
I mean, I understand that the metric is reproductive fitness. I understand that that's kind of baked into the qualifier of your theory that yes, that nothing else matters other than we're able to reproduce somehow. Let me ask you this. Does evolution care about this? How is this its metric? How has that become its intention, if you will?
I don't know what you mean by that.
So 100 years ago, we might have said that the point is to become smarter. We want to know more about the universe. That would be us evolving. That would be us becoming more fit. Different people would say maybe athletic, tendencies. We're more fit athletically. We have a longer life expectancy. There'd be a lot of different ways you could use as metrics to qualify if we're going in a positive or a negative direction. So the idea that it's about reproductive fitness only. How new is that, I guess? I mean, I know Denton talks about it. I know that's a big part of this evolution. I guess, do you think evolution is working towards reproductive fitness? Like, this is kind of its intention.
Yes, because I mean, that's the only thing that natural selection really can do is that. Now it's possible that the population just, it's possible that the environment, the conditions just suck so much that the organism goes extinct. I mean, that happens all the time. But natural selection really cannot, the natural selection process, really, I guess, with regard to the organism, an organism can't decrease in fitness, really, not overall, because you'll have variation in your population, and not all those variations are equal, but the variations that produce better, like statistical odds for reproduction or whatever, those continue to accumulate. And so the species, well, I mean, that's kind of the crux of how natural selection happens and evolution happens. But so do you want to talk about mutations?
Sure.
So let's see. Let's again, hold on. I could approach this in many different ways. So this genetic entropy thing, it starts with Stanford or Sanford. Sanford is his last
Sanford.
name.
Yep, John
So
Sanford.
he seems to kind of ignore the fact that natural selection happens because, like, you'd have to either, the only way for Sanford's idea to work is if you believe that all mutations are always bad. Now, we have experimental evidence that demonstrates that that just simply isn't the case. But, or the other implication would be, well, maybe like 1% of mutations are beneficial, and then like, who knows, half, 50% are neither beneficial nor harmful, and then about whatever we have left, 49% are harmful. Even if most mutations were harmful, that still wouldn't really matter because we have natural selection. So even if most are harmful, those with better mutations, we'll just say this all very simply. Those with better mutations have statistically better odds of reproducing, and so the next generation will be composed of more individuals that have the genetic composition of that 1%. So that 1% grows to a bigger number, and then it grows to a bigger number in the next population. And basically, harmful mutation or harmful mutations or whatever gene frequencies, whatever, are weeded out of the population. They never disappear, but they never accumulate to this level where something like genetic entropy or whatever would happen.
So I'm fairly well versed in the pro and against Sanford argument. I think that what you're saying is kind of, I don't want to say standard. I want to like pigeonhole you into that, but it's like, yeah, we know that only a small percentage are positive, like 1%, and we know that the vast majority or the majority are neutral or negative, but we also know that for some reason, and I forget the name of the Japanese guy who did the study. It's slipping my mind right now. Anyways, he's got a paper on it. He basically shows that even though we are aggregating neutral and deleterious mutations at a much more rapid state than any kind of positive mutations, that somehow there's an equilibrium that's being reached inside of the DNA. I think that's kind of the conclusion is, yeah, we see all these negative and neutral negative mutations, but the net isn't changing for some reason. Is that with that is that kind of part of your argument? Like they are happening, but somehow in the end, it's not wiping us all out.
I mean, they happen, but they don't accumulate, right? Is the main thing because they never have good statistical odds of accumulating. I mean, like albino organisms exist. It's not like extinct. It's not wiped out of really any genome or whatever. But you never see them because they never accumulate in the population, basically. But the thing about like if genetic entropy was really happening, then what would happen is every single population on our planet would be declining, and that just isn't the case. Now, some scientists I
Why?
think we're in the middle of the sixth mass extinction or whatever. And for amphibians, things are really bad, probably mostly due to like chemicals that we produce are getting into the environment. And for certain plants, apparently it's extremely disastrous. I don't know why that is. But no, overall, populations are not declining on our planet.
Okay.
To the extent that any of them are, quite a lot of it can be described by like obviously like human intervention, I guess,
Right.
because we're destroying lots of environments and adding a lot of carbon to the oceans.
Well, and microplastics and destroying the gut bacteria and using all kind of, chemicals in big ag and spraying DDT down the streets, 50 years ago or whatever, 60, 100 years ago. So yeah, a lot of negative human interaction, unfortunately, environmentally. Okay, I think it's a really good direction to go on this because unfortunately, I know the genetic mutation thing ends up being a stalemate. We might go back to it, but people are saying in the chat, we're living longer. How could we be devolving if we're living longer? Well, I certainly believe. Go ahead.
Humans don't live longer. It's just that the only reason average lifespan is better is because fewer kids die. Like even in the
Right.
United States 100 years ago, infant or well, child mortality, which is below five,
And
was like
mother.
20%.
Right.
Calvin Coolidge's son died because he got a blister on his foot playing tennis. That's how like sad our state of medical intervention was 100 years ago,
Right.
right? Because it wasn't uncommon to find 60, 70-year-old people hundreds of years ago,
Right.
you
I love
know?
that you said that. Most people don't know that. Most people think that everybody died at 30. They just have like a really skewed version of history and they think that
I'm
everybody
writing a
died at
new
they were
book, and
30.
that's going to be one of the things in my new book.
Cool. Yeah, I did a video a couple years ago, went viral. We're devolving was basically our ancestors were superheroes and we're devolving. Had like 5 million views and a ton of people saying, we're evolving, we're life expectancy. And I was gonna do a follow-up video, and it's exactly what you said. There was so much untimely death. A mother would have 10 kids, and a lot of times she would die because having children was dangerous. One of the two children would die at birth. As an infant, up to 2 years old, they would get a fever and die. Whatever. Then you'd have a farm accident. Somebody would die in a war, and somebody would die of a tooth infection. These kind of things that you're talking about. So these things happened, but those who didn't die of these things were very strong people largely, and were really fit into their 70s and 80s. And I was fortunate enough, I'm 46, I was fortunate enough to work in the golf industry, and I knew a lot of the World War II generation. I knew a lot of tough 80-year-old guys and girls. And anyways, so yeah, it's people have that wrong, that basically, if not for our medical system, everybody would die at 30. Yes, there was terrible death, and our advancements in basically critical care, fighting infection, blood transfusions, traumatic healthcare has absolutely extended our life. You don't die of a toothache as much anymore, so that's happened. But so the question was, why are we living, or why are we not dying out? Why is our population increasing, right? If we're genetically entropically degrading, why do we have more people than less people? Wasn't that your
Yeah. Well,
question?
it's not just us. It's literally all species.
Except for the ones that are going extinct.
Well, yeah, but if genetic entropy is true, it would be true for everything. But we don't see populations declining in everything. And we have
I just
technology, and they don't, but still.
it wouldn't be true. It would be true if the universe was 14 billion years old and the Earth was 4 billion years old and life was 4 billion years old. Do you have ghosts in your house? I heard that. What was that?
I don't know. It's outside.
Oh, sounded like a leopard, like a
I don't know.
panther.
It's I don't
Do
know.
you hear that? It was creepy. You should be freaked out. Hopefully, it's not like the movie Scream. So if your chat's gonna love this, but I'm a young Earth creationist. If we've only been around for 7,500 years, you're not going to see. Yes, if we're here for 400 million years, we should have evolved out of commission. But if we're only 7,500 years old, I think that even in Sanford's estimation, he thinks that we could get another 10,000 years before we're so riddled with mutations that we can't even reproduce. So I don't, it, 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 to
Well,
me, it's
but
just a time thing.
Yeah, but I feel like that's an internal contradiction, because if genetic entropy is happening, then fitness should be decreasing. Thousands of years is, I mean, for some organisms, that's hundreds of thousands of generations. For others, it's tens of thousands of generations. I don't understand how it could possibly, and like, according to, if you believe the flood, there were only a few thousand species on the ark. How the hell did a few thou if every generation genetic entropy is happening, how could only a few thousand species have diversified into millions of species? And it seems like to me, it sounds like the idea that, well, eventually genetic entropy will hit a threshold in the future, and then things will collapse. That just sounds like there should be a term for this, like deferring to the prophecy. I don't know. I just invented a
I like
brand new
it.
logical fallacy. Deferring to the prophecy, where it'll happen eventually, but it hasn't happened yet.
Well, the I think a good example of genetic entropy or, potentially us going in the wrong direction is the survivability of wolves compared to every other dog. Now, granted, that was hugely human interaction, right? We started really breeding for functionality and cosmetics, etc. But I've never thought this through, so it could be entirely an ignorant argument, but I would say that a good portion of the dogs that we see today would have a much smaller survivability rate in the wild than would wolves. So
Well,
like
yeah,
you
but they're not naturally selected. Dogs are not, we don't have dogs because of natural selection.
Right, I said
They've been
good human.
purposely bred,
I
or
said
they've
that.
been bred for a purpose,
Right.
and so it removes a
The
lot of these
self-sorting.
survival instincts that nature would place on them.
I agree. I prefaced it by saying I know that humans have been involved and have kind of guide they've certainly guided dogs more than any other species, but you still see a scenario in a very short amount of time where a pug, a chihuahua, a boxer, a poodle, that they're this is a mutation aggregation situation. Like that to me, that's an evidence of genetic entropy. Now, it's a small scale version. I understand it's one species and it's human influenced, but this is what actually aggregating mutations looks like, is at some point a non-functioning something that can't live in the wild.
So I would agree that inbreeding would produce something that looks like genetic entropy. So while I don't think that genetic entropy is real, something like genetic entropy happens. Like, for example, there were woolly mammoths on Wrangel Island when the pyramids were being built, which is really fascinating. There were now they went extinct, and I don't I think I looked into this at one point, and they think maybe climate had more to do with it. But if you have a population that's trapped on an island, it's kind of hard to accumulate a lot of genetic diversity, especially because African elephants have a gestation period of like 18 months. Mammoths probably had a similar one. It'd be very hard to accumulate enough genetic diversity for a small population to be sustainable. So, in other words, it produces a lot of harmful inbreeding. You can have a small population that actually is not really at a high risk of going extinct as long as they have high genetic variability. Because there are some species that there just naturally are not very many of them, because they only live in like one. There's like types of fish that only live on underneath of one waterfall in one place in the world, but they're able to do okay. But anyways, sorry, I'm kind of rambling, but your point about like the inbreeding with the dogs, I actually agree with, but again, natural selection cures that. We actually have really good experimental evidence going over this. I wrote about it in my book. There's things called forced inbreeding experiments. If you, I have a scientific paper on it that's called, if you want to look into it, Spontaneous Mutations in Diploid Saccharomyces cerevisiae. I mean, if you get the first four,
Saccharomyces cerevisiae, yeah, that's a
yeah,
yeast.
if you get the first, it is. It is. Yeah, if you get the first four words, well, you know the rest, so what am I telling you for? So here's what they do. They basically, you take yeast, which breed really quickly, and you basically force, well, you take them at first, and then you get a baseline level of fitness. So you get a graph, right? You get a bell curve, and it'll be a really tight bell curve displaying their fitness. It's basically tracking the rate at which they reproduce. Some reproduce faster than others, but the majority of them are right there within like one standard deviation, right? Then what you do is you force the yeast to inbreed. Now, I'm not sure how they do that, what the
If that's
method
very
is.
ethical.
Well, they're just
I'm just
yeast.
kidding.
I
I'm
don't think they
kidding.
don't have a nervous
Yeast,
system,
dude,
so I don't
yeast
think they
lives
can
matter.
suffer.
All right.
But anyways,
It's 2023, Eric. I'm just saying.
you know what? You're very correct.
Just
anyways,
yeast, man.
you
At
do these
least I'm
forced
a
inbreed experiments, and forced inbreeding removes natural selection. It's like what we do with dog breeding. Now, after a period of, I'm just gonna read from my book if that's okay.
Oh, yeah, I love
After
it.
a period of forced inbreeding, a graph of the population shows significant changes in the overall fitness of the population. Instead of a tight bell curve with no extreme outliers, you end up with a flatter bell curve with extreme outliers. You'll end up with a significant number of organisms with far lower fitness than the average because of the forced inbreeding. Weirdly, you also find some outliers with much higher fitness than the average than you do if before forced inbreeding. One
Yeah,
more
this is
paragraph.
the.
One more paragraph.
Oh,
One more paragraph.
please. Yep.
These experiments clearly show that natural selection cures a population of harmful mutations. There's always some amount of genetic variation among a population. Some of that variation is good, some is bad, some is neutral. When organisms reproduce under normal conditions, natural conditions, those with average or good fitness reproduce more often than those with poor fitness. Therefore, despite the presence of harmful mutations that lead to poor fitness, those mutations do not accumulate over time. There we go.
Right. This is what I'm gonna say Nakamura, but I could be wrong. I know it's a Japanese name, so hopefully that's the right name. But there's a very long experiment on this that I had referenced earlier. I think it's Nakamura, but whoever it is, maybe somebody in the chat knows. But they're seeing the same thing, what you just said with this yeast population, which is mutations are aggregating. And mostly deleterious, neutral to deleterious, but fitness is staying. Is there's an equilibrizing, whatever, of fitness. It's not just diving straight off. So even with this that we're talking about, we see the potentiality for, I think, stagnation. I don't think we see justification for increase of functionality and of course, I believe God created this and he understands entropy. And I think it's a brilliantly designed adaptive information code that information is, that DNA is, I'm sorry. And so for it to sustain itself and for it to have like an equilibrium and not just wipe itself out in, 100 or 1,000 generations, I think it's, yeah, that shows that the design is adaptive and it's necessary in a very difficult, reality, different difficult universe, difficult Earth, different difficult challenges. We have starvation and floods and droughts and solar radiation, all these things. So it's very well designed to not just dip off the deep end. But what I don't see with your argument is it working in an inverse way where we end up going from tadpole or whatever that you believe the original thing is to human. I just don't like even like to defend it and go, okay, we see negative mutations mostly, but there are a lot of neutral ones, and it turns out it still ends up being able to reproduce. Well, that doesn't end up to me, evolving flight or sight or
Sure.
the
Well, I
brain.
mean, a
I
small
just
scale experiment isn't going to produce results. I mean, like funny enough, if we somehow saw an organism in a very short amount of time start giving birth to organisms that can fly, that would count against evolution
Right.
because evolution doesn't propose that something like that can happen in
Right.
that amount of time, right? But like we've known, so I think we've circled back to what we began with, which is like your contention that Well, you said evolution or natural selection isn't creative, right?
Kind of. I said what it's a, yeah, what's it selecting from? Like that's the issue to me.
But like, so the way this would work is, and I wrote about this in my book too. I'll do a,
Everybody just buy Eric's book. Every
yeah.
do
Well, it's
throw
not out yet, but yes, you
Okay,
should
well when it comes
eventually.
out.
We've known for a long time that genes get duplicated. So, for example, these guys, Brown et al., they're multiple authors. So they grew yeast in a limited sugar, in a sugar-limited environment. And after 450 generations, genes controlling for the transport of sugars were duplicated several times. So this allowed the yeast to be more efficient and increase their fitness. Now, typically, what people retort with is, yeah, but that's just a duplication of information that already exists, right?
Transcription, right?
But if we know mutations can happen, then a gene that gets duplicated can mutate to the point where one of those copies can begin to take on a slightly different form. And this would happen many different times. And it's how gradually different features would arise. So like for example, there's a type of fern that has like 12,000 chromosomes. It has like the most preposterously large genome of any organism on the planet. And there's no, like, why would that happen? Well, because genes can get duplicated over time. Like it's a thing that happens. Humans have multiple copies of some genes.
Yeah. Okay. So, some people are theistic evolutionists, and if you want to believe that, the science is so convincing that God did this, and there was a not even like even if you don't want to believe in the God of the Bible, you believe a designer set in motion, the way that this thing could play out, fine. But random processes, random unguided material processes creating this. It's gonna take a real convincing data set for me to go, okay, this is even a valid theory. Much less what I actually my contention is, which I want it to be. You're not gonna like this, but I don't want the children to be taught that it's been proven. I want there to be more transparency. Hey, this is a good theory. The Big Bang was a good theory. Hey, we had a good theory, then it turned out we were wrong. Fine. But it was a theory, and I think this. I put Darwinian evolution in the same boat. There's too many problems. Abiogenesis, the idea of this is a simple thing, but how do you justify? I guess I would ask you this: how do you justify
But you believe
seeds?
natural selection happens.
Yeah, I do. Yeah,
Well, that's what we teach.
kind of.
Well, I mean, there are different implications for it, like that life is ancient and that species change, but I mean, we would have to, like, even in your worldview, we would teach natural selection.
Right, adaptation's a thing. Yeah, I'm fine with that. But the phylogenetic tree and, 400 million years ago this and 200 million years ago and five, whatever, all that stuff. Just at least be transparent. We believe this shit. Like, hey, we think it's this way, or we want it to be this way. Whatever you'd want to say. But like, with my channel right now, I know you don't, we don't catch up on each other's content, but I just posted a video of the discovery of paleontologist Paul Sereno in Niger, where he found dinosaurs and humans in the same layer of strata. And it's obviously people are loving it because they say it's not the same layer of strata. And he's not saying it's the same layer of strata. He's a evolutionary advocate and very secular academic, but they're within 30 miles of each other, and there's dinosaurs sticking out of the ground, dinosaur fossils sticking out of the ground, and humans actually just a little bit subsurface in the same area. The soft tissues in the dinosaur bones. It's a big deal, dude. I know we've talked about it, and you just want to dismiss it. There shouldn't be soft tissues in dinosaur bones. There shouldn't be dinosaurs peeking out of the
There should be
surface.
soft tissue in all dinosaur bones, but there isn't if they're only a few thousand years old.
I'm fairly certain that if you do the treatment that Mary Schweitzer's done, I can't confirm this, but there is soft tissue in all dinosaur bones. I'm pretty sure that's where we're at with it. If you have to dissolve away with the
I
acid.
mean, but Schweitzer didn't even actually find soft tissue. They placed the bones in acid for really for days. And then when they rehydrated it, it was flexible. That's really different than saying the actual soft tissue was there. I mean, I don't know, that's kind of like saying beef jerky has a blood supply to me, except I think it's a little bit more extreme, but
No, it's just that's certainly marginalizing what they've actually discovered. I mean, it's, and I understand why. Like, basically, the soft tissue in the dinosaur bones is one of a handful of things that's blowing some huge holes in this theory, and I understand why science isn't touching it. But Jack Horner, I have him in a TED talk right here,
but
I could show you.
scientists discovered it and they openly talk about it.
They don't openly talk about it.
Yeah, they do.
Do you guys, is it in any of your curriculum?
I don't think so, but paleontology isn't really in any of the curriculum except for like just the very basics of how does a fossil form and then what is the
We
like
all
the
know that
principle
doesn't
of
count
fossil
though.
succession, I guess, is in there. But like, well, anyways.
So this, I just want to catch you up on this really quickly. This is Jack Horner in a TED talk. It's like 2 minute sound clip. I can show you the video too, but just, we can't marginalize what they actually found.
We all know that bones are fossilized.
Let me turn my camera around.
And so if you dump it into acid, there shouldn't be anything left. But there was something left. There were blood vessels left. There were flexible, clear blood vessels. And so here was the first soft tissues from a dinosaur. It was extraordinary. But she also found
And
osteocytes, which are the
this is Jack Horner, and trust me, he not only does he's not advocating for the soft tissue, he has done his own part to cover the whole thing up. I showed him my video,
He was a
you know.
co-author of the paper.
Yeah. But he's not he's controlling the narrative on what it is. It's cross-linking, we expected to see it, we're not going to discuss this anymore, and that was kind of the end of the story with Jack Horner and Mary Schweitzer. I mean, I can get really conspiracy and you know, people aren't going to appreciate it, especially people on your side of the aisle. You know me, Dale Gribble. But yeah, no, okay. The video that I have on my channel of a radio host named Jack Enyart. Jack Enyart offered, he was on a recorded line with Jack Horner, and Jack Horner didn't know that it was being recorded. And he said, Jack, I want to, oh, Bob Enyart is his name, I'm sorry. He said, Jack, I want to carbon date. Your soft the soft tissues that you found. And he goes, "Nope, we're not doing it. You know you can't carbon date fossils." And he goes, "Yeah, I know that, but there's not supposed to be soft tissues in fossils. Can we carbon date it? We're going to give you a $20,000 grant." And he said, "Who are you with? Who are you working for?" And he goes, "It's just me. I've got a, you know, my church here in Denver. You know, we're not attached to anything." And he goes, "Well, let me shoot you straight. We don't want to let you do this because it would cause a circus and the young earth creationists would have a heyday with it basically." And he refused to carbon date the soft tissue in the dinosaur bones. And I understand why. Because if they carbon date these and they turn out being 30,000 years old or 18,000 years old or 8,000 years old or whatever, because of stratigraphy, because of the stratigraphic layers, and that they're all radiometrically dated and we know how old they are, the whole thing comes crumbling down. The whole thing comes crumbling down. So yeah, it's like, don't test it. And look, I know the science, Schweitzer discovered it. She hates young earth creation. She hates when people use this for young earth creation. She did a cross-linking test where she fused it with iron, and she in 2 years there wasn't deterioration. So they threw out the experiment. No one's ever tested it ever since. It's questionable, man. It's questionable. And you know, Horner's got a lot in on this. He's got the whole dinosaurs turned into chickens, and he's got the NSF giving him tens of millions of dollars trying to make a dinosaur chicken. He's at the end of his career, whatever. I don't know, I just don't trust him, man. I don't trust that this information is not being controlled, and I think it's a big deal. And I think the fact that it's not being taught in school and there isn't a discussion about it, I would say it this way, and I could show you the video. When Mary Schweitzer made this discovery, I almost want to show you the video. She wasn't excited. She had just made potentially the greatest discovery in paleontologic history, and she didn't go, "Eureka, I figured it out." She was afraid to tell anybody, Eric. She was afraid to tell anyone. Because she was going to be ridiculed, and that's the scientific actual climate that we're in. If you come across like if there was intellectual honesty in science, they'd go, "Holy shit, soft tissue and dinosaur bones. Maybe they were here more recently." No, the lady who made the discovery was afraid to say anything because
Well,
of the
yeah, but it
truth.
did get published.
It did get published. B Rex, I want you to hear her say it, Mary. Schweitzer. It's just I don't know, I just want to live in that world personally where you make a discovery like that and everybody hears about it. And it's not, kind of what it is, which you have to be kind of a conspiracy-minded young Earth creationist for that information to even get out. That's frustrating for me. Let me see if I can find her talking about this.
That's bone. That's how you can tell.
Yeah.
Because the bone is fit.
Oh my God.
Rocks don't do
literally break apart.
Dinosaurs.
Dissolve his dinosaurs.
Yeah.
We found the first most president.
Schweitzer. Team. Sticking out.
Impossible.
Is he just thigh bones after all?
Said it's a girl and it's.
Birds produce yet another link. We put some fragments of the bone in acid. No.
It
was. And it was elastic, like living tissue.
This is the piece.
No. She showed us video she took under the microscope.
That's really what happened?
Yes.
That's the dinosaur bone?
Without mineral now. That's what was left.
It looked like the soft tissue she would have expected to find if it had been modern bone. This was impossible. This bone was 68 million years old.
So you see this and you think, what? You
see, I didn't want to tell anybody.
You'd be ridiculed,
yes.
Right?
And so I said to my technician, okay, do it again. I don't believe it.
And yet, in sample after sample, they were there. Things.
Yeah, and so that, and that's not like Mary Schweitzer isn't the only case. I could just do, I could pull up right now Rebecca Kahn and Mark Stoneking, who discovered mitochondrial Eve, which destroyed convergent evolution, the multi-regional hypothesis. They came out and they go, hey, we found out we're all there's one woman that we're all related to, which obviously I know your interpretation of that. And same thing. She was met with the same thing in science. They attacked her, vehemently attacked her. And she said, they said in this article I could pull up, what was the biggest surprise to you? And it was that she was having to defend to the, what I would say, the dinosaurs, the old guard of scientists, why her data isn't a threat and it's not her fault that she made a discovery. It's like, don't you want to live in a world where you find soft tissue and dinosaur bones? It's like, oh, well, great discovery. Let's talk about it. No. Don't you want to live in a world where you find out we're all related to one woman way back in the past and the scientist isn't attacked? We don't live in that reality. We live in the reality that's like, defend the narrative at all costs, and anyone who opposes it is going to meet the fury of whatever, the scientific enterprise. And that, to me, that's intellectually dishonest. And the more you are on the side of truth, the more transparency you should invite and the more you should be able to question it. Science is about failure. Cool. Well, we just found out that the Big Bang has failed, and we just found out the universe isn't locally real, and we found soft tissue and dinosaur bones and all these other things. Like, maybe it's time to just question what we were taught and stop being dogmatic about it.
I mean, so, okay, well.
You knew what you were getting to.
The soft tissue thing. If that was evidence that they were actually really young, then I feel like we should find soft tissue in almost all fossils, but we just clearly don't, right? I mean, you don't take a statistical outlier and say that it explains the full range of data.
Right.
Another thing, though, is no DNA has ever been pulled from any dinosaur fossil.
I know.
We have pulled DNA from fossils that, so like the conventional. Like, the secular science is telling us that these fossils are this many millions of years old. But then the secular science also shows soft tissue being in there. So the secular science proves that the secular science has been debunked. Well, hold on, because secular science has also told us that some fossils that are, you know, merely tens of thousands of years old, we can get DNA out of those, but never, ever, ever out of any dinosaur fossils, right?
Right.
I don't think that, like, this soft tissue is like elastic tissue and cartilage and stuff like that. But they're not finding, like, you know, DNA or blood or anything like that. I feel like that should be, we should be finding that, and we're not in any.
So the DNA thing, I mean, it's really interesting the way science addresses what you just mentioned. They say it can't last more than 1,000 years or 5,000 years. It depends on who you talk to. But there's a scientist in Greenland who, if you don't know this, both Greenland and Antarctica at one point were tropical. I'm sure you know this, were tropical environments. And this scientist in Greenland is harvesting DNA out of the soil that he says is millions of years old. So it just depends on who you talk to about what DNA we can and we can't get. I don't know particularly. But I did just look up soft tissues and other fossils, and they found Zhang and his team in Queen Zhang, along the banks of the Dashui River, have found a bunch of soft tissues in, what did they find here? What are they in? Remarkable and how dramatically it opens up another unique window. Some sort of sea creatures that are supposed to be 60 million years old, and they have soft tissues in them. So it's whatever this Queen Jing biota is 10 million years older than the Burgess Shale, and they found a bunch of stuff. Metazoans, multicellular animals, are finding soft tissues. There's a bunch of those kind of, like, yeah. I think they're finding, I don't think they knew really what to look for with it, and I think that they're finding them in all, in a lot of older things. So the paradigm's just being rewritten. Nobody's considering that maybe they were here more recently. They're just saying that the material survived longer than they thought. But then you've got, like...
Well, yeah, but I mean, soft tissue isn't a dating technique. I mean, if you want to say that this is evidence of that, then okay, but you need to actually find, a dating method, and none of our dating methods support the idea that any of these fossils are young at all.
My understanding is that they will not carbon date the soft tissues found in the dinosaur fossils. They will not do it.
It doesn't have a half-life that can get you to
right.
How old they are. Like, you don't have to carbon date it. We can date it with some other method, and those methods reliably tell us that they're many millions of years old.
It's radiometric dating based on the strata. It's a combination of radiometric dating and stratigraphy, and there's a lot of questions, I think, in the validity of those things, but that's obviously a side note. But you can't date the bone because you don't have radioactive material. This isn't, you know, uranium or something, zircon.
Yeah, you have to date, like, nearby things. If you find it's underneath some volcanic material, you can date that. And if it's above other volcanic material, you can date that. Then that tells us, well, it formed after this, but before that. And that's where we narrow our timelines.
Right. Well, that's the idea. That's the idea. It's the stratigraphic. It's a geologic column. This area is this old. This area is this old. This area is this old. We know that this uranium decay rate is steady. We know what the original parent to daughter ratio is. We have our numbers, so we have these. Fine. Then why is a dinosaur that's supposed to be 170 million years old sticking out of the surface? Well, because of erosion. That's what the answer. But because it came out of the ground and then it eroded. Okay. Then if that area eroded out, and in some parts of the world, fossils can stick out of the ground because the strata uplifts and then blows away, but in other places, the strata doesn't do that, and if the theory is that over time we get more layers of strata, so the deeper something is, the older it is, but then at the same time, you can have something that's 200 million years old at the surface, it's basically just whatever fucking date they want. It's just whatever. Like, it can be at the surface, or it can be 100 feet, or it can be 200 feet. It doesn't matter.
It's not dated based off of how close to the surface it is, though. It's dated based off of, like, radiometric techniques.
It's dated off of assumptions. It's dating games.
The only way we can do science is to make an assumption. A hypothesis is an assumption, and then it's tested scientifically. And most hypotheses are proven false. The ones that produce reliable, accurate results are the ones that are said to be scientifically sound.
Right. And I agree with that. And I think I'll be really critical. We're in the dark ages of science. I'm convinced of it. That, you know, we make fun of people like 500 years ago, we thought the world was flat. And we thought that, you know, if people like... And, you know, I'm not a flat earther, so I, like, legitimately think it's fun. They should think that. The thing they think that today is a whole other conversation. I digress. But, you know, it's the sicknesses in the blood. If we bleed them, they'll be fine. And we had all these ideas, and we look back and we go, why would they believe that? They're going to look back at this time in 2550 and be like, what the hell were they doing? They believed this and this and that. And it's going to be like, oh, yeah, it turns out we were in a scientific technocracy that you couldn't question. And if you questioned them, they just silenced you and they shut you up and you couldn't get money. And you couldn't. So you could all, if you wanted to be in science, you would just do what they wanted you to do and you could have a nice, comfortable job. And it's like, wow, that's weird. It was like a tyranny. It's like, yeah. So hopefully we're not in this tyranny and we crawl out of it. But